When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, folks. How you doing? Sorry, I don't know why I'm whispering. Well, I'm whispering because I'm recording this at 12:30 on Thursday night into Friday morning. I've just got back from a really lovely day, which has been pretty much taken over by lots of creatives involved in The Death of Bunny Munro, which was the Nick Cave book that has been turned into a series. Clerkenwell Films have made it for Sky. It's going to be available from the 20th of November. Matt Smith in the lead role, the fabulous Sarah Green, and this young kid, Raphael, who plays Bunny Jr., who's 9 years old when they filmed it. Anyway, I was very lucky that as part of the London Literature Festival, they had a kind of premiere of the first two episodes and then a 45-minute Q&A that I hosted with Nick and Matt. It was so much fun. They were on great form. Nick's kind of, him and Warren have done the music for it, hopefully going to get them for a soundtrack and episode soon, talking about that. But he's been kind of part of the journey in and out sort of thing. But it's so good. It's kind of, it's one of those things that Nick kind of loves to do where he kind of creates art that provokes. So yeah, definitely well worth checking out. Anyway, that's why I'm recording this so late, because I want you guys to have this episode on Friday. Because, you know, that's what we do now. Sorry, Ben. Is we throw two episodes a week at you. And yeah, the bonuses, folks, they just keep on coming here on Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Thank you for your time. Sorry, I went into a bit of a rant at the start. Not a rant, but a kind of like an overshare maybe, or just a share. But here we are with another episode. And on this particular episode, Edward Berger makes a welcome return to discuss his new film, Ballad of a Small Player, which is streaming right now on Netflix. Stars Colin Farrell, Tilda Swinton, and it tells the story of a kind of high-stakes gambler lying, well, lowish in Macau, who can't quite hide from his past. Colin Farrell in the lead has created this kind of whole persona of someone that he's trying to hide from himself, basically, and not face the reality of his real life. If you think about the films of Edward Berger, I know that you probably think of All Quiet on the Western Front, Conclave, both kind of considered films. This is so kind of colourful and so different, so interesting. I kind of just really love how different it was, really. And weirdly, coming off the back of the conversation I was having with Nick and Matt tonight about the idea of so much of the content, films, TV shows that we're fed are so safe and so kind of like they don't really challenge you. And I really like when things do. And so I think that's one of the many things that I loved about this. Tilda Swinton is phenomenal in it. Colin Farrell, I just love his choices, you know, everything from The Penguin to this to Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey. He's just on a on a really interesting journey at the minute with his choices as an actor. So yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. I also just was looking up, and Edward, if IMDb is to be believed, is directing a new Bourne film. I am in for that. Anyway, before we get to Edward, I wanted to share a little extract of our next episode, which features a really lovely creative collective that we've not had that often on the show. So we have a writer-director, then we have cinematographer and composer, Clint Bentley, Adolfo Veloso and Bryce Desner from The Nashville, who will be discussing their collaboration on the quite beautiful and almost meditative Train Dreams. Here's friend of the show, Bryce, on what was asked of him for the score.
This is the fourth film that Clint and I have worked on, and the second that with Adolfo as well. So, you know, I scored Trenspecos and Jockey and Sing Sing last year that Clint co-wrote with Greg. And so there's a lot of, it's like a band, kind of like
another band.
Yeah, we communicate a lot, and I knew the book. I had read versions of the script. We had talked quite a lot before Clint started shooting, and obviously the American West and the American landscape, American identity, these are things that I think about a lot, and that there's a long tradition of music inspired by it. And so there was a lot to work with from the get-go. But I think, you know, so it sort of went in two phases for me. I wrote quite a lot. I actually got excited and also went to the Pacific Northwest around the time they were starting to shoot. And so I was, I took advantage of a tour, actually, where I had like, you know, 4 or 5 days off near Portland, Oregon. And I also really wanted to get away from some recent scores I've done that were really all, you know, a lot of times it's sort of late in the game and you're forced into a deadline and you're like sitting at home in your computer working with samples that will then record that. You know, I was like, I don't want to do this film that way. Mm. So I really decided to go into old recording studios, old analog studios, and using like ribbon microphones and old upright pianos. And so there's some beautiful, a lot of the scores recorded at a place called Flora Flora that's Tucker Martin. It's like an old recording studio in Portland, Oregon, where the Nationals worked, where some R.E.M. albums were recorded. It's really not the place you record film music. In fact, even it was the first time they'd put a monitor in the live room.
Oh, wow.
And it was this huge, you know, like, where do we get the cable? I'm like, you know, but it's a fantastic, it's a really, you know, it has the most incredible gear. So it's like members of the Oregon Symphony. Mm. And these were all off picture, like a suite of themes that I wrote inspired by Clint's script and the book and the discussions, and that I was seeing stills from their work. And that's about half the score, and including the main theme, were recorded in that way. And then working to picture was a real joy, because it was really like, it had so much, the cinematography and just what they had done with the film, which is that there's a lot of room for music.
Yeah.
And music had kind of like almost like a character, a role to play. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of, and it was challenging. It was like a beautiful challenge.
Bryce Desner, alongside director and writer Clint Bentley and cinematographer Adolfo Veloso, ahead of our episode with them on Monday, which is not to be missed, and has got a Nick Cave connection. There we go. Let's move on to A Ballad of a Small Player, which is scored by another former guest on Soundtrackin', Edward's regular sparring partner, Volker Bertelmann. And we'll begin with his cue. Sit back and relax.
I'm good.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah. I'm really good.
Yeah.
Another film festival, another award season. I love it. It would not be the same without you, Edward. For sure. Oh, man.
Maybe we'll get Volker back, huh?
Oh, I know. We did it remote. Did we do it in person last time or remote? I can't remember.
I forgot.
Yeah.
Let's do it always in person.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I love this background as well.
Isn't it great?
It's like so good. Yeah. This is such an immersive experience, this film. I kind of, in a world that I'm intrigued by, and it's kind of got a real
like a real sensual kind of like, you know, sort of persuasiveness to it in a way as well, which really ties in, I think, with the character of it. What was your kind of introduction to these characters in this story, I guess, is a good place to start.
I guess I read the book.
Yeah.
You know, Mike Goodrich, the producer, sent it to me. Like, oh, we had lunch and he said, like, read this book. And I read it about 8 years ago. And I really, same as you, I was sort of fascinated by this world. It was exotic. I didn't know much about it. I've never been there. And I wanted to, but I was curious. You know, it was just like I was trying to quench my curiosity about the place, about the people that live there, and about this guy, this crazy guy who goes there and just pretends to be someone else. I'm really drawn to stories where I can make an immersive experience, but just on actually nothing. It's just actually his internal journey rather than having big shootouts and car chases and trying to make it immersive by people just sort of working out that internal action sequence within themselves.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good way of putting it. And it is also that thing as well, I think, of where the notion of us being able to escape or run away to another part of the world and create a completely new persona. There's something really romantic about that as well and kind of really appealing.
Yeah, I read a couple of articles of people basically inventing and found its way into the movie, inventing, you know, you can buy a new personality in Manila, you know, for a couple of, like, a death certificate and a new passport and so forth.
Oh,
and
wow.
Just and actually in Japan, there's a whole industry of people, like, disappearing, you know, like, moving to other cities and erasing all with a new name.
Yeah.
Running away from debt or family members or whatever it is.
And I think so much about the way that I connected to this is so much of your collaboration with, you know, your amazing heads of departments and production designers, DOPs and things, but also those performances are really quite something special. And kind of Colin, the performance in that is extraordinary, the inner turmoil and the pain and the kind of, you know, the way he's trying to be almost like physically kind of drawn into the world that he almost doesn't quite know whether he needs to be in it. Talk to me a little bit about the casting on this as well and Tilda as well. It's just, it's so colourful and vibrant.
I think that's a good term. You know, I wanted the movie, I mean, the movie is a pretty dark subject matter. Mm. And I wasn't so interested in making a movie about a dark subject matter in a dark way.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be fun and operatic and over the top. And in the end, it's a celebration of life rather than a, and so let's put all the colors and walks of life into it and mix it up and let it explode into the world. And I saw, it was really interesting. I saw Bruce Nauman, the artist, show in Hong Kong when I went on the first recce there. And he had, like, just a little sidetrack here, a segue. He had one of the quotes that he had, I wanted to make art that hits people in the face with a baseball bat. And it kind of, that's what Macau does to you. And that's kind of what the movie needed to do with its colors and the like, only to find peace in the end. So I wanted to put Colin on that ride and the audience on that ride. And the casting is just, if you go through to do something that goes into, you know, into rock bottom and is about a, you know, he says, I'm a liar, I'm a thief, I'm a scoundrel, I'm a fraud, whatever those words are.
Mm.
You know, you need someone who you like to take you on this journey.
Yeah.
And we like Colin, don't we? Like, he's just he just emanates kindness and generosity.
Yeah.
And he just gives and gives and gives, no matter to who, to the crew, to the other cast members. When he performs, he gives to Tilda. You know, she comes and goes like, whoa. You know, you really literally see it on her face. Like, I shot Colin's close-up first, I think, and he just does it. And he goes, and she does, whoa, all right, I'm going to have to give back. You know, like, it's inspiring.
That's
it inspires
so great.
Everyone.
I guess so great, because I imagine that actors don't get that all the time. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, and I do think that he's not an unsung hero, but I just think he's got so much in him. And I think that, like you say, it kind of comes from such a kind, genuine place that he's able to play so well and just to really stretch out to different areas that people kind of maybe don't expect him to be able to reach. But another character is the location in this, for sure, you know. And you talk about going to Hong Kong on a recce and Macau as well. I guess there was never any question that you would not shoot in those locations, or
no,
it had to be
there.
Yeah,
it's just so specific. I wouldn't have known where to do it. And it's problematic because there's no tax break, you know, it's expensive there, you have to put the entire crew there, and so it's a it's a trek, and it's not very plannable. You know, there's a lot of insecurities with shooting there, with the government and the casinos and so forth, and high rollers coming in, taking away the location because they want to spend their money there. Yeah. So it's not a very smart way to make a movie, but it's kind of a compulsive way, and it was so, you know, it had to be. It's just there was no way around the place. It's part of the movie.
Yeah, and did that bleed into the conversations that you had with Volker? You know, in terms of there being the story, there being the characters, but there also being this location that is kind of so important to how we experience it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wanted, you know, we always want to make music in the film that kind of comes from inside of Colin. Mm. And it's maybe in the beginning, it's boisterous and bold because he is, you know, presenting himself to that world. He has a ridiculously green suit on. And so the music needs to be, bah, here I am. You know, and we've seen behind the facade a little bit. Mm-hmm. We've seen a glimpse of him waking up. And so it needs to be that. And it slowly crumbles and becomes more fragile and influenced by his experiences and by the people that he meets and by the place, and slowly becomes quieter and more poetic, I guess.
Were there any specific kind of reference points musically you had for this film?
I think opera. Let's be operatic and let's be bold and let's be, bold and boisterous. I don't know specifically like any songs or cues, but there's one source music in the movie, and that actually came from Colin. It came from him. It's the gorging yourself on lobster and steak and everything. And I remember sitting there and filming it and thinking, where the hell does this music come from? It's bothering me. I want quiet. Until I realized it's Colin listening to it on his headphones.
No way.
And the good thing was it fit the scene. You know, it was the great atmosphere for the scene. And so I went over and said, what is this? And it was Bach. And it was like some organ piece, some manic inner organ. And so I felt like, that's perfect. I'm going to put it in the scene, in this movie. And so, you know, it's a good way to explain how aligned Colin and I were in terms of he knew what type of movie I was making. I knew what he like put into this performance, where it came from. And Volker took that as an inspiration of, all right, if that piece is in, then I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
So it all informs each other.
I love the idea of you going, where's that? Yeah. Where's that music
Bloody
coming from? That scene's extraordinary.
Yeah.
That's kind of like the obese kind of just overindulgence of it is. I can't imagine what it was like for him. I imagine there was maybe a few versions of that had to be done.
Nice guy that I am.
Yeah.
I only did one take per setup.
Oh, wow.
Because I thought, I'm not going to get a great performance. I'm going to do five takes per shot, and I don't need it because it's like 5 seconds here and 4 seconds. And I knew where it was, but I didn't want to cut it up too much. So I cut the whole eat. Like he went through his motions of, I'm going to eat the steak, I'm going to eat the lobster, I'm going to eat the bread and the cake and drink the champagne in sort of the same order, maybe sometimes different. It didn't really matter. I don't care about the continuity of it,
and
especially in that scene. So, and I knew, okay, I'm going to film that. Let's start with the close-ups to, like, get it out of the way and really have them. But because by take 3 or 4, you know, it's, like, hard. It's hard to put all that food into yourself. And so we probably made like 15 different angles.
And I love that shot with pullback where you, you see him in this sort of doorway of him running away from the table to be sick sort of thing as well. It's the physicality of the character as well is... it's kind of really something. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask if you'd had a conversation with Volker about the kind of, you know, I don't want to give anything away really for an audience who haven't seen the film yet, but obviously there's a question about reality.
Yeah.
Or real situations in
well
the film.
Well put.
Thank you.
Ambiguously put.
Yeah. But when you're thinking about how you score that side of it so that you aren't giving anything away to the audience so that it's, you know, it's keeping the audience guessing in a way as well. That's got to be a really, because, you know, because music has that ability to tell us something before it happens sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's got to be so cleverly kind of thought out in terms of if you have music at those points and what that is as well.
You know, it's a little bit different with here because in China, the belief is a very different belief than the Western belief. You know, that reality exists. It doesn't really exist in our...
Yeah, I love that.
In our world. So it didn't have to be that different.
Okay.
I mean, we treated her... we treated it as the real thing, you know? And who knows? It is, for me, it's real.
Yeah.
You know, it's real. And it's real for the Chinese audience and might be real for some... And I like that... there might be a discussion afterwards between you and your wife or husband when you watch the movie and go like, what do you think? When did that happen? When was it real? What was not real? What was imagination? What was ghostly? All those things, you know, can be a discussion and that's totally fine. Who cares what's real?
Yeah.
Actually, the really nice thing that Tilda said in the beginning, and that's why we went also had fun with her costume and her hair and so forth, and she invented this character. She said, like, when making a movie, reality is boring. And that's kind of a little bit the motto.
I love that.
You know, reality is, come on, we have it every day. Let's make a movie.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that whole kind of, almost the silhouette of her as well. It's kind of like the hair and the glasses and the clash in the colours and all that. It's so brilliant. And I guess it's that from her reading the script that she's kind of, like you say, it's like it's play for actors, isn't it, in terms of them bringing it to life. And costume is such a big part of that.
It's and if you know Tilda's public persona, you know, you obviously know costume, fashion, appearance, you know, hair, whatever, is an interesting part of her, you know, it's a performance. You know, she's like... a full performance, the whole persona is a... And it's interesting that you use the word silhouette because that's what she used on my first phone call with her. She said, I always start with a silhouette. What do you think is her silhouette? And I was imagining this. Can I show you a photo? And she held up a magazine, a photo shoot that she did where she basically dressed up, had a wig, a Queen Elizabeth wig. And... I was there with Heike, my makeup designer, and Lizzie, my costume designer. The four of us were on the call with Tilda Holzhauer's magazine. I go, oh, that's a great idea. Let's try it. And so Heike and Lizzie go away. Heike does the, you know, the wig, you know, like draws it, basically. We sent it to her. And she's like, and so obviously the Queen Elizabeth is period. And so we took the inspiration and took it into today. And then Lizzie does the shape of the costume, her silhouette, and then bit by bit, Tilda works from that silhouette to inside. You know, she starts from the outside. She looks at this person. Oh, that's what that person looks like. I'm going to play her like her, like this. You know?
So great. The tone of the film is brilliant as well. You know, there's proper... there's so many moments where you're allowed to laugh.
Good.
You know, and
I like laughing.
Me too. Me too. It's like some of those moments where, with those two particularly, but then those moments with Colin, you know, where he's going like, I don't even like champagne or I don't even like cigars, all that kind of stuff as well. It's this kind of realization of kind of actually what he needs as a human. Exactly. What a waste of life sort of thing as well. I imagine a lot of that was in Roman script, but also a lot of that is down to the performance of your cast and how you direct that and the freedom that you give to kind of... the timing is so important with those types of things as well, because what might hit dramatically might not hit comedically.
Yeah. I mean, that is really watching... you learn so much from Colin and Tilda and Fala, watching them and realizing how good they are and how much they take from each other. And just, it's very often, it's actually a lot of the comedy came from Tilda's reactions to Colin. And I think a lot of it came from that she realized how vulnerable he's going to be and how open he's going to be.
Mm.
And then because she was like much more of a square person, right, from England and this detective and hunting him. But he touched her. He touched this woman's inside.
Yeah.
And then she said, she slowly realized, I'm going to have to show that. And it was so beautifully tender. Mm. It actually turned out to be a kind of a tender love story also between those two.
Yeah. Farrell is amazing. And, mm-hmm. and that kind of almost, it's almost like a levitational performance in a way in terms of the way she moves. It's such a kind of poetic movement to her kind of presence in those scenes as well. And makes such an impact on Colin's character, like
yeah.
massively.
Yeah.
And that location that's out in the island, that's just so stunning. I could just have a kind of spin-off film of just that
yeah.
as well.
And you know what it felt like? Because we had shot about 6 weeks in Macau. Mm. And Macau is basically you're locked inside in air condition and hardly any windows or no windows in the casinos. And you lose track of time. We shoot a lot of nights. It's very hot outside. So it's you're quite locked in, and there's no nature. You know, everything is plastic. Even the lawn is plastic. You know?
Wow.
And so plastic and marble and glass, you know, and steel.
Yeah.
And so shooting there, and I really wanted a tiny crew for that. I thought, like, okay, we're going to be on this small pontoon mm-hmm. in the middle of the water. Let's be 10 people, not 50. Because if we're 50, it's going to be chaos.
Mm.
So we're really 10 people quietly recording the sound and the audio, the image of, you know, these very tender interactions. And
yes.
for the first time, it's also Colin waking up in basically in heaven. You know, it's nature, it's lapping water, it's wind and trees, mm. it's chirping birds, so all that stuff. And you see it in his face. He suddenly, he relaxes. And hopefully the audience relaxes into that with him.
Yeah.
Not for long, though.
Yeah, and his linen pajamas.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure, definitely. Those kind of little details, though, like the gloves, the way that he looks at the cards,
mm-hmm.
all those kind of like little details are so connected to so much of the storytelling sort of thing. And those was that in the script about how he looks at the cards? Because that's
No, it wasn't, because we learned it in Macau.
Oh, wow.
Basically, we walked around the casino floors. I don't gamble. I'm not interested in losing money. So I just look at it and I'm curious why people do it. But what I was curious about is there were, like, around the tables, you know, a lot of people started assembling when someone won.
Yeah.
And so they're lucky tables. Mm. It's really the belief in luck. Baccarat is an entire game of chance, you know. It's
yeah.
like you toss a dice and you win or you lose. And so there's no knowledge to this or no technique to it. But the one thing that really does happen is they look under their cards. They squeeze the cards, they call it they squeeze the cards, meaning they don't show what's on there, because they believe by blowing the card or by chanting a certain, you can change the number that's on there. And you can change your luck, you can change your fate. And so all the gamblers squeeze their cards and they carefully look under them before revealing, hoping that the right one is on it. Yeah? And so that's what we took from those gambling floors.
What do you think changes his fate?
Love, encounter with Dao Ming. That's ultimately the battle in the movie, greed or love.
Mm. So great. I think you've just, the team that you've brought together on this have just been amazing. It's just such a great experience to watch. It's so lovely to chat to you.
Thanks you so much, Edith.
From the Score to Ballad of a Small Player, that's All of It by Volker Bertelmann. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Edward Berger.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Huge thanks, Edward, for taking the time to talk to us. Always a pleasure to chat to him. Ballad of a Small Player is streaming on Netflix now. So do subscribe if you haven't already, as there are loads of great things, including Kathryn Bigelow's new film, House of Dynamite, which I promise I am trying to get my hands on someone to talk about that. Volker also did the score for that, which is flipping great. Edward and Volker have appeared on the podcast a couple of times, and you can find those interviews just by heading to edithbowman.com, in addition to all the usual places you get your podcast. We're also at Soundtrackin' UK on your socials, and we've got a YouTube channel called Soundtrackin' Extra. Do subscribe for plenty of bonus video content. In fact, we are sticking up the interview ahead of going on the podcast with Rebecca Miller, who is director of many things, but most recently Mr. Scorsese, a phenomenal documentary series that is up on Apple TV Plus now. So Rebecca's going to be up on Soundtrack and Extra talking about working with Marty on that. She's also the daughter of Arthur Miller, playwright, and married to Daniel Day-Lewis, and the mother of Ronan Day-Lewis. What a talented family. Anyway, next up, as I said, Clint Bentley, Adolfo Veloso, and Bryce Dessner talking about their wonderful film Train Dreams. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.